Two action items. One, I recommend approval of naming of designated rooms and areas. Those are all found on pages 72 and 73. We went over those in our committee meetings. Do I have a motion for approval on that?
So moved.
Any discussion? Second?
Second.
Okay. Now any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
And second action item, acceptance of university's 2012-2018 six-year capital plan. Catherine, any comments today? You had spoke.
Oh, yeah. Let's do the capital plan first, and then come back to Catherine on the campaign.
I want the capital plan. That's John.
Yes. What you have on pages 74 through 76 is a executive summary of the capital plan that was submitted to the Capital Planning Advisory Board and to CPE on April the 15th. All state agencies are required to submit capital plans for the 6 years in advance of that upcoming General Assembly. And when we do, when we do that, it's in preparation for the General Assembly that will prepare the biennial budget for 12-14, which will meet or convene in January. They use this, the state uses this information to identify statewide what are the capital needs and priorities across the state. This plan is more than just a funding request. It is a needs assessment. By no means are we anticipating funding for only the top priorities of the institution, but the remaining items are there so that we can identify needs that are on the campus. And then when they prepare the budget for the 12-14 period, they will roll up from our plan into the budget bill many of these items so that we have legislative authorization to enact or initiate projects as approved. Our capital plan reflects our strategic priorities. It includes and it is consistent with our campus master plan. The master plan that we shared with you in January, that was a draft preliminary, will be finalized with you at our July meeting. This plan places a focus on restoring the architectural integrity of the campus and emphasizes capital renewal, renovation of existing facilities, and upgrades our campus infrastructure. And with your approval today, this this capital plan positions us to continue with the physical transformation of the campus that we began in 1998.
Thank you, John. Any questions on the capital plan at this time?
I had one question.
Sure.
I noticed that the Honors College Building International Center has been split. Previously, when this came to us on capital plan, that was rolled into one, and it was over here in federal other. And I see Honors College is now in agency bond and is standalone. Or is that still a work in progress?
Well, that is absolutely a work in progress.
I believe you were referring to item 14.
Item 10 and item 14, which used to be one item.
Construct International Center is a backup plan.
Sure.
As you're well aware, the Navitas Honors International Building is dependent on revenue from Navitas.
Right.
And in the event that revenue is not forthcoming, we thought we would add a line on the international component of that.
Okay.
But the plan is still to for those to be wrapped together, but until we get the funding source secured, we got to have plan A and plan B, because the six-year capital plan, if you don't have something in this plan, you can't do it.
Exactly.
You cannot get authorization to proceed, and we didn't want to bind ourselves having to go to plan B with an international center a variable or project, but not be authorized to do so.
Sure.
I mean, and there, for example, there are other backups or placeholders that are in there, such as the acquisition of land. We don't know exactly if or where, but at this point, you've got to get it in there so that it's in the budget bill. It gives you authorization when the budget is approved to acquire land if you wish to.
Yeah, great. Thanks. I'm also thrilled to see that renovation for Helm Craven's Library has hit the capital plan, which is fantastic. Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? All right. Do I have a motion for approval?
Hold on.
We had
a hand.
I'm blanking on what CRD stands for. At CRD, there's...
The Center for Research and Development.
Okay.
Yeah, we get carried away with our acronyms when I try to create executive summaries.
When that lease expires in the Center for Research and Development, that we will convert that to a space to be utilized for future partners in the Center for Research and Development that will be consistent with the purposes of that center.
Any other comment?
The regional campuses.
Yes.
I see there's construction south on number 5. It's Glasgow.
Yes.
There's other things included for the other regional campuses here, too.
Yeah. In order, we have Glasgow, Owensboro, Phase 2, Radcliffe, which is the regional center that we're leasing in Radcliffe, and then the Construct Central Region Education, Post-Secondary Education Center in Elizabethtown, which is the proper state title for that campus, if you will. So we have Glasgow, Owensboro, Radcliffe, and Elizabethtown covered there. And again, those numbers, don't put too much stock in those precise numbers, but if we had to project right now what the next buildings on those campuses would be, would entail, it would be a project in that range. Completely different needs and dynamics in each of those four projects. I mean, Glasgow is simply, we're out of space, and we need to construct a second building on the Glasgow campus in order to continue to meet the demand for student matriculation to that campus. And the Downing Center number is that we just talked about, needing the additional authorization that will complete the authorization necessary for the DUC project. But those first few projects are in priority order. Beyond that, timing and circumstance, and you're not likely to get to them, but the numbering is less relevant once you get beyond the Downing University Center.
I would only comment that you'll notice that campus infrastructure is number 2. And if you'll see our campus and what we're going to be doing this summer, it will be very striking. We are going to have to do 5 locations on campus to replace steam lines that are underground. It's going to be incredibly disruptive and messy, but we do like our heat when the winter comes. So,
yeah.
So it doesn't look like a geyser in front of Minton.
Yeah, well, in that case, we had to live with it because I didn't want to turn the heat off in the building. So the students thought I should fix the leak, but I also thought I needed to provide heat. So what I'm getting at is that our infrastructure and our distribution of steam and of electrical is incredibly important. It's and it's a duty, we think, of the Commonwealth of Kentucky to assist us in. But what we're doing is, in absence of any direct state funding we've been able to secure for this, we're doing it in parts and pieces and only where necessary, with the anticipation that we can get the Commonwealth to assist us.
And we're talking about steam and electrical lines that are at best 50 or 60 years old. In some cases, we have underground infrastructure that might even be 70 years old. Brian?
We have a lot of stormwater infrastructure that might be failing. It was built with old clay pipes. We also have added for the summer another large section of domestic water to 3 of our buildings that we had to make some repairs, and when we got into the ground, it critical. The steam line for catastrophic failures that could not be repaired. We are to that point on this campus. It's out of sight, out of mind. We've been asking for additional funds from the state to help us. And as John said, we're getting into our critical needs money each year, trying to replace small sections of these where needed. And we just continue to ask for help.
And not much forthcoming. The state has not had money for capital projects now for, they were in the second biennium, so we're heading into the fourth year we're without capital projects or relief on these matters. And, you know, it's a catch-22. Because of our growing enrollment, because of our growing budget, we create some capacity to address some of these things, but every time we use our own resources to address these things, it becomes less critical in the mind of the state to fulfill its responsibility for this state agency. And so it's, you almost feel, you hate to use your own resources to do it, but we can't ignore the problem, and the state's in no position to do it. So it's that's just the financial dynamic.
Well, there were three biennia where the state had a matching pool for deferred maintenance, and they discontinued the funding for that pool. And so we have no choice now but to put it in this kind of request, because we were doing some of that as a match project, dollar for dollar. And so I would say, as we discuss with the General Assembly the priorities of the institution, restoring the matching pool at least, and that's why this is number two on our list, is an incredibly important priority.
Okay. Do you have a motion for approval?
So moved.
Second.
All right. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Thank you, John, once more. Catherine, I always try to get you in ahead of John. I don't know why, but...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, ma'am.
You had in your packet some written material that you updated since our last meeting with $176.4 million, and there are a few gifts highlighted. Since I've been very brief in the past and willing, Mr. Chairman, I would like to share something that we sometimes don't talk about. When we see these numbers, we forget that one of the reasons we've been so successful is because of the culture of the institution, the bonding of the alumni to the institution. People like Dr. Downing and President Ransdell today are leaving that same kind of footprint with students. But staying in touch with alumni is more critical today than ever. They're very mobile. They're mobile in the way they communicate, and they're mobile in travel. So I would like to take just a few minutes and let John Ward show you one of the things that WKU is doing that's kind of leading the pack of other institutions, which is a very innovative online magazine that uses multimedia. We're one of the few, and he'll tell you about that. It's just about 3 or 4 minutes, so I want to keep my good rapport with you for this, but I'll introduce Sean and let him share it with you.
You're doing good.
Thank you, Catherine. My name is Sean.
You're on target now.
My name is Sean Ward. I'm the Assistant Director of Marketing Communications for the Office of Development and Alumni Relations. I'm here today to show you our iPad app for WKU Spirit. We have printed copies over there that Jeff has, but what I wanted to show you is our app. And it has all the magazine versions. So you can go back to previous issues. But the most recent issue I wanted to show you is one of our feature stories. What we're able to do is add multimedia into the magazine. So it's more than just ink on paper. It's actually an experiential readership. If you click the play button, the actual audio.
Rose has been teaching at WKU.
Get around this thing. Sorry about that.
Beyond the vast cave and karst areas in this region.
Some of the things that are going on now or have happened, I couldn't really have imagined 10 years ago or even 5 years ago.
Dr. Chris Groves is talking about the product.
And as you can see, that's one example of the video that we can do. We can also have, scroll to the next page, external links where we can have additional content that pulls up from other websites. So it's more of an experience in the magazine, more than just the ink on the paper. and our growth rate is about 500% from issue to issue. We've only have three online, but we're up to about 8,800 unique readers, and we have over 2,300 downloads of our app. So if you have an app, a tablet, an iPad, I would definitely encourage you to go to the App Store. It's free. And download it and experience it online and ask for the push. So as soon as the magazine hits the newsstands, we actually push the content to you. So the magazine comes automatically to your iPad. And I'll be happy to answer any questions that you might have regarding that.
Ty, you might tell them what you found about other universities and how far ahead we are in our...
Yeah, most universities just have what I call a PDF page turner, where it's just a PDF file that the pages are just turning. We're able to incorporate the multimedia with the help of people like Clinton and Amy that are already creating content. We just repurpose it, and we're working together to create new content for faculty and staff, and we're working together as a team, and it makes it easier for everybody because we don't have to go out there and find our own content. We're using everybody else and a team effort between actually divisions in this particular case. It's been a lot of fun, and we're continuing to do it.
I've installed the app on my iPad, but to remind the group again, when you go to the App Store, what do you type in?
Yes, sir.
To secure the Spirit Magazine app?
It's go to the App Store and search WKU Spirit, and it should show up. And then as you upload it and install it onto your iPad, ask for the push technology, and it'll come up, and it'll just tell you and just allow it so that the new magazine will actually just show up on your iPad. And it is only for iPad because as a publisher, the iPhone is just too small to really experience the magazine the way that we would like to show it. Any other questions?
I thought you would enjoy seeing something upbeat.
Good job.
Chairman, as you notice in here, some of you may want this to pay attention to. The gift that took us over the top in Sky Teach, and that was another alumnus, John Ruther, and his wife, Carolyn. And if you get a chance to see them, they kind of came in at the end when it really mattered to finish the project. So thank you very much, and thank you, Sean, for your good work.
And are scheduled right now for the groundbreaking on the Alumni Center in July 15, and you're actively raising the balance of the funds necessary for that project.
And I should pay tribute to Dale Augustine, who spent a week traveling with Donald Smith and me and others, and he has determined that we'll raise $7 million, which actually makes Amy very happy. Perhaps even more. But he's devoted so much volunteer time in making dozens and dozens of calls, and he's back again, I think, today, and will be working over the weekend. So we've had a really good team out there, including the namesake of the building, Bill Augustine. So thank him too much.
As you leave town or as you're here today, you might just drive by that Center Kentucky Street site. You'll see the parking structure, concrete. It's like an erector set. It's going up.
It's very exciting. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. It's a very good report. Second information item. Concerns the president's valuation. Thank you so very much for getting these valuations back to me timely. You all did a tremendous job on that this year. After I got them all back, they were all tabulated, and Dr. Ransdale has reviewed all the evaluations and the tabulations, and we've had conversation about that. Again, it was a very nice evaluation. The vast majority of our board is overwhelmingly happy and pleased with his continued excellent work as president and CEO and leader of this university. There's no discussion on that. That's just an information item, and that concludes that. Now I will move on to other business, and that's just the calendar for upcoming events. I'll not read that. You may read that yourself, but after that, that takes care of our business as far as the executive committee. Does anybody else have anything that they might want to add? I do have one thing. Excuse me. I know you're getting ready to say something. Judy. I'm appointing a committee to come up with a slate for the chairman, the vice chair, and the secretary beginning July. We'll have that for you in the June meeting. And so that will be taken care of, and we'll have a new sheriff in town beginning in July. Anything else?
Committee assignments will be made
right.
During that time frame as well. You should have received, Julia, I presume everyone has the schedule for commencement weekend, May 13
yes.
or 14.
It's not in your packet, but it was emailed to everyone. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Give me another
yeah.
copy.
I'll just remind everyone that we will we'll have a full weekend in that we have the graduate ceremony Friday evening at 7 and then 3 ceremonies on Saturday at 10, 2, and 6, and the shuttle will be running back and forth, and we'll have respites between ceremonies at the president's home, so you will be fed well and have time to relax a little bit, but you are, I assume that we have sign-up sheets for who will participate in which ceremony, so we know ahead of time, that will be an exciting and full weekend of commencements. This will be the first time we've done 3 in one day, but that's the price we pay for degree productivity and the security of being in Diddle Arena as opposed to the uncertainty of being in the stadium and keeping the ceremony, trying to keep it 2 hours or less for each one so that those who are participating in each ceremony can enjoy the experience without having to be there for an extraordinarily long period of time. So we'll see how this works.
Thank you, sir. I noticed that we have a distinguished guest to speak to us today, and just came in, and we're right on target. We're not making him wait a second. In fact, we're getting started a couple of minutes ahead of time, but we've got CPE President Bob King to address our board today. And Bob, thank you so much, sir. You have the floor.
Thank you very much.
No, you're perfect.
Get my desk here. First, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to come in and speak to you. The CPE, which I have the great privilege of heading up, has a number of responsibilities, one of which is by statute, every 4 to 5 years to kind of reassess where we are on a statewide basis in terms of higher education and to craft a new strategic agenda that continues to move us in the direction that was articulated when House Bill 1 was first enacted in 1997. As I suspect most of you know, Governor Paul Patton was responsible for creating that legislation and shepherding it, sometimes bludgeoning it through the legislature. Governor Patton is still involved. He serves as the chairman of our board today. And this new agenda is an effort to stay true to his vision for higher education, which was to recognize that if you boil everything down, that higher education is this state's and any state's single most powerful tool for growing the economy and the prosperity of our Commonwealth and our country. This effort, which I'm going to take you through, and as we do this, what we wanted to do and what I'm attempting to accomplish is as I get around the state now meeting with boards of regents at each of our campuses is to share with you this overview, which kind of looks at the state and our longer-term objectives, not with the intention of supplanting that which you do here at campus, or the strategic agenda or strategic plan that's been developed here, but rather to put a context around it. And so as you move forward, and wherever you are in the process of your own strategies here on campus, is to see how they can fit into this, and over time, as you develop new strategies going forward, to the extent that all of this can integrate with each other, I think you'll see that it can work. We were just at, as I'm reminded by President Ransdell's colleague at Normal School Number 1 earlier this week, and in fact at Eastern Kentucky University, the strategic plan that they have had in place for a couple of years actually fits very nicely into a number of the themes that are here. And so I suspect the same will happen here at Western, but let me take you through it. First, what we did is put together a set of advisory groups, obviously representatives from our campuses, from the State Department of Education, from the Higher Education Assistance Authority. Those are the people that do grants and aid, both the Keys Scholarship, the CAP, and KTG. The Professional Standards Board, EPSB, that's the group that certifies teachers so that they can practice in our classrooms. And every one of our campuses, certainly here at Western, are training hundreds of teachers every year. The workforce and economic development cabinets, business leaders, the State Chamber of Commerce. So we tried to bring to bear in our thinking folks who have different perspectives around the state, but all of which touch higher education or our product called our students upon graduation in one way or another. Here are a couple of our challenges, and let me say before I go through this, if you were to go back a decade, or back to 1997, the data shows that this state and our campuses, and literally every one of them, have made significant progress in terms of achieving a very simple objective, which is to get more people more highly educated. The numbers in terms of enrollment, in terms of credentials awarded, whether it's a PhD or an advanced practice doctorate, which is coming along, or it's a master's or bachelor's degree or an associate degree or a certificate, that those numbers on an annual basis today, we have doubled the output of our campuses in that respect over the last decade. But even with that progress, we continue to lag behind the national averages, and more importantly, in my view, while we have set achieving performance numbers at the national average as a goal, and this goes back to 1997, the reality today is that our national average needs to be improved. And in fact, there's a talk that I give, I won't do it today, where I demonstrate that when I graduated college, when Gary graduated from college, the United States was number one in terms of the proportion of our population that had at least a bachelor's degree. Today we're number 10 or number 12 and falling. And that difference in terms of the gap we once enjoyed between us and everybody else has evaporated. And if we are going to regain that prominence and the prosperity and the security that goes with it, we're going to need to accelerate even faster the progress that we're making. So here's a quick, very simple, I guess, description of our challenges. First, the population, while we continue to be interested in adults who earned a high school diploma, maybe started college and never finished, but are now finding a need to come back, or people who maybe never went to college but have found later in life that they need to come back. Our principal focus is the age group 25 to 44. Today, in Kentucky, That population, about 32% of our residents, hold that level of post-secondary education. The national average is just under 40%. President Obama has set a goal for the country by 2025 to get that number to 60%. So you can see the challenge that's out there. 57% today of those students who choose to go to college show up ready, in other words, ready to take credit-generating courses. But that means that 43% are not. And part of our challenge, and you'll see how we address that in a minute, is reducing the number of students coming out of our high schools and choosing to go to college who are ready to learn, ready to take credit-generating courses. 47% of our full-time students at our baccalaureate institutions are graduating in 6 years. That number is below the national average and below where we need to be. And in terms of the state's rankings on measures of economic competitiveness, you have all seen them in one form or another, but we're not where we need to be. And we need to be addressing these things at a time when the larger fiscal environment of the state and the country is where it currently is. So the challenges are quite substantial. And let me come back to this issue about underprepared students. This is the composite rate of graduation for four-year, five-year, and six-year. This is at our baccalaureate campuses. And it includes both our public and our independent, private and independent colleges. Here's the rate for those students who come in prepared, and you can see it's significantly better than the composite. Here's the rate for the students that come in underprepared. This is really at the core of our challenge. Kids coming in prepared are graduating at just about twice the rate. Ignore the four-year rate. That's probably a thing of the distant past, you know. But if you look at the 5 and 6 year rates, it really does tell the story. And so part of our plan, which I'll get to in a minute, is to try and get at this problem. There's another issue, and that is the difference in graduation rates between those students who are low income and those that are moderate or upper income. It's not as great as it might be in some other states, but again, closing that gap is something that's important to us. And if you look at it in terms of minority students, the gaps tend to be even greater. So again, one of our challenges is to close these gaps. This is kind of a simple schematic of what we've done. First, like any strategic plan, we have a vision and a mission, and link that to what we think are important values that guide our thinking. Second, and this is really at the core of our plan, these are the four focus areas that we have identified: college readiness, student success, research, economic and community development, and efficiency and innovation. For each of these, there are specific sets of objectives. There are metrics to measure how we're doing in each of these respects, and those metrics, which I'll get into toward the end, are really vital pieces of all of this. The strategies to accomplish these different objectives and to improve the metrics, and then a state-level implementation plan. This is a very detailed plan for me and for my organization in terms of the things we can do to help our campuses achieve all of the objectives that are embedded in this plan. And then finally, action steps for our campuses and for CPE. So this is kind of the big overview of how all of this works. What I'm going to focus on is the four focus areas and a little bit on the metrics. But underneath all of this is a lot of very detailed information, and strategies that have been developed in conjunction with our presidents, with our chief academic and business officers across the system. We had very detailed meetings with our presidents going through each of these, and I think I can report to you that there's pretty broad consensus that our campuses will support this and embed in the things that are going on here all of these areas of focus. Vision is pretty simple. To get all Kentuckians prepared to succeed in a global economy. And this notion, one of the graphs that I use in that other speech I'm not going to give today, I have a graphic that shows educational attainment levels in different nations across the globe and how they've improved over the last 40 years. And I include in there what I call the country of Kentucky. And people smile or laugh a little bit. And I said, well, no, understand this. We are no longer competing against Tennessee and Indiana and Missouri. We're competing against Singapore and China and Western Europe and areas of South America that are emerging for jobs and for opportunity. And we need to understand that and think of our needs in those terms. And the mission is pretty simple. It embeds or it incorporates the core of what we do on our campuses, obviously. Here are the four focus areas. And let me talk about college readiness. We talk about this and are taking a step here in Kentucky that I can tell you because I interact with people who do my work in other states. That if we are not the only state, we are nearly the only state that is making a very different commitment here than has been made anywhere else. What we're saying is, in large part, that we are going to take on ownership, not total or exclusive, but partial ownership at least, important ownership, of helping K-12 be successful. And the reason is, if you remember those graphs I just showed you about students coming to us underprepared and not succeeding at the rate that kids who show up prepared are, that really is at the core of the issue. What we know is that we can be more successful in terms of getting our students to the finish line if we can get them to show up ready to learn at levels that we expect students to be able to know. So the question is, how do we influence what happens in K-12? We don't run the school boards. We don't hire the superintendents or the principals. We don't set the policy. But here's what we do. We decide right here at Western Kentucky which students we will admit into teacher education programs. We decide what they need to learn in order to earn a degree. We decide whether or not they've met those criteria and hand them a diploma or not, saying to them and to the world that this person's ready to become a teacher. And so the quality and the effectiveness of our teacher education programs, and related to that, our principal preparation programs, are vital to the success of K-12. And so we're committing in this plan to take a new look, a hard look at how our teacher preparation programs are functioning. And I'm delighted to tell you that what's going on here with SkyTeach and the other work that's happening with your dean are leading the pack here in Kentucky. And we want to see that expanded, not just here, but across the Commonwealth. So part of this college readiness stuff is our commitment to really elevate the caliber of the people that we're going to put out into the world that intend to be teachers or principals. Second, there's a core of about 43,000 to 45,000 teachers in our state who are out there working right now. And every one of them is obligated to participate by contract in something called professional development. It's kind of ongoing training. What we know from national data is most professional development being conducted across the country is totally useless. Higher education, for reasons that I don't fully appreciate, has not been very actively engaged in regular, effective professional development. And so we have been meeting with Commissioner Holliday and members of the legislature to try and understand what it would take to get higher education more fully involved in participating in and developing high-quality, effective, relevant professional development for classroom teachers. The good news is that we've identified somewhere between $60 and $70 million that flows through the state budget and out to school districts to fund this. And the commissioner has committed that he, to the extent that he has authority, because most of the decisions about where professional development is secured from happens at local districts, at site-based councils, but to start to encourage, to the extent he can, and direct our public schools to turn to our campuses for the provision of this professional development. Now, it's incumbent on us to develop the program and the quality material. But that's, again, part of this commitment. Third is to continue to do research about what works and what doesn't in terms of learning and enhancing content knowledge, inviting our teachers back to our campuses for more than a football game and an alumni event to get refreshed in their discipline or to learn the latest techniques in terms of pedagogy, assessment, classroom management, etc. So when we talk about college readiness, the reason we're talking about it is because we know it is in our business interest to have K-12 be successful. The legislature 2 years ago in Senate Bill 1 has directed the state to adopt new standards. Standards are the words we use to define what students need to know at the end of third grade, fifth grade, eighth grade, tenth grade. The problem for years has been that the standards being used in the public school system weren't aligned with what we expect students to know coming to higher ed. That's why so many, it's not that these kids are dumb, it's that we've been teaching them the wrong stuff. And so this statute, very powerful and important, compels us to create this alignment that has been missing. And so this is part of, but going further than, that legislation to engage our campuses, public and private, in this larger mission of helping K-12 be more successful. I'm going to go through this a little bit better here, a little faster. Student success. We know that we've got to get our graduation rates up. And so the second part of this agenda is all about what can we do to maximize the likelihood that every student that we admit is going to get through to graduation. Whether it's intrusive advising, whether it's better counseling and advising services, tutoring, all of the things that we think can be done to help support students be successful will be part of this effort. The other is the elimination of these achievement gaps, which I showed you. Now, the numbers I gave you are statewide. They vary from campus to campus. I can tell you, particularly for students of color, that these gaps tend to be the most profound. It's not that they don't have the talent. For many instances, it's because the public school systems that they were in did not give them the preparation that they need. So they come to our campuses. We put them into developmental ed programs. For many of these kids, even though they may have been getting good grades in high school, because they haven't been learning the right stuff and don't have the right study skills, they get to college and really struggle, and then we lose them. And so this is a way of bringing focus to this issue and redoubling our efforts to improve the success rates for these kids. Number five there is finance. You know that we met yesterday at CPE and approved new tuition As a matter of fact, Western was right there ready to go so that we could approve your tuition increases for next year. The pressures are increasing to further limit our capacity to raise tuition in future years. And obviously there is additional pressure from the legislature because the finances of the state, the private economy, are impacting the state's economy. We have a couple of challenges there. Part of it is to try and discourage state government from reducing funding to higher ed, which they have been doing kind of in a steady erosion, and as generally supportive as the legislature and the governor have been. And if you look across the country at other states, our legislature's been pretty darn good to us. But the numbers show that there still is this steady erosion of state support. That puts pressure on tuition, obviously, to try and make up that difference. But at some point, there's a market pressure that comes back to us. And the pressure is most substantial for students in lower middle income and lower income families. And as we know, when we look at the numbers of students who drop out, often finances are the cause, not academic issues. And so one of our challenges is to try and find more resources and to hold down our price to students long term so that we don't deprive people who have the talent and the motivation of access to our campuses. I would say also that it's going to increase pressure on our campuses to do more fundraising in terms of philanthropy to support student scholarship and other resources for them. But there's a series of strategies related to that. In addition, many of our campuses are building these summer bridge programs, again, to deal with this readiness issue and to have students, when they show up at our campuses, actually ready to learn. These summer bridge and transition programs are actually, in many cases, now being pushed back into the junior and senior year in high school, where our faculty are working with high school teachers, specifically targeting those students who are testing not yet ready based on the ACT exams that they take while they're in sophomores and juniors in high school, so that we can identify the kids that have deficiencies, get those deficiencies remedied before they get to our campuses. Early alert systems, as I mentioned, looking at supplemental instruction resources for those courses that tend to have the highest rates of failure. I'm going to come back to metrics in a minute. In terms of research, economic, and community development, one of the things that I think gets lost in a lot of the public discussion is an attention to the importance of research. While we focus so heavily on undergraduate education appropriately, we can't lose sight of the reality that this country is dependent in very large part on high quality, both basic and applied research in our universities. It is a practice that was really blossomed at the end of World War II and through the latter half of the 20th century. Those resources and the capacity of our institutions to create new knowledge, to take that knowledge, apply it in new ways, and out of that create new companies and new jobs is really at the core of how our campuses can play a vital role. And the work that you've been doing here, I've been over to that research facility you've got over in the old shopping center, is one example of how we can take the brain power that resides on our campuses and translate that into commercial opportunities and job growth. There is this other notion that is equally important, and that is to have our campuses, our faculty, our administrators, and our students engaged with the communities we serve, particularly those where we reside. There are learning opportunities for students, and there are obviously critically important relationships that can be built between our campuses and our host communities so that relationships there remain positive and that we can add value to the quality of life, whether it's having our folks serving on school boards or zoning boards or helping a local community deal with a particular local problem, whether it's developing a downtown or a streetscape or improving social services, and again, translating this into learning opportunities for our students. And then finally, everything that we do, because we are publicly funded, we have an obligation that we recognize to do as effectively and as cost effectively as possible. How we do our instruction to how we buy paper clips. We owe our taxpayers and our legislators and the governor a commitment to do it as efficiently as we can. And so this last objective really kind of transcends all of this and commits us to using our resources as wisely as possible. The good news is that while we have taken reductions in funding and we have been able to restrain the growth of tuition over time, the amount of money that we now have to spend per FTE is actually $500 less per student than it was 10 years ago. And we are producing twice as many credentials as we were 10 years ago. It's a pretty good measure of efficiency. But we've got to continue to do that because the pressures on our budget and in the marketplace are going to continue. Now, let me direct your attention to this. You have in the book, this is towards the back of our book here. These are the metrics, or a description of the metrics. And you can see there are some statewide metrics, there's institutional metrics, those are the things that will pertain to Western specifically, and then some regional metrics. Those also will pertain to Western in a way. What is about to happen is a group of my staff and me on occasion when I can do it are coming out to our campuses, meeting with our campus presidents and their senior administrators to actually develop and negotiate the specific measures that this campus and each of the others will commit themselves to achieve under the auspices of this plan in each of the areas under the institutional set of metrics. Okay, and you can see that, for example, in the top one under college readiness, the one metric we're going to use, at least to start with, is how many of the students who graduate from the teacher ed programs at this campus score in the top 15% on the national Praxis 2 exam. It's kind of an unusual measure. It's not an easy thing to measure, and eventually we're going to replace this with a more comprehensive assessment of our teacher ed programs, but that's an example. And so what we'll be looking for is when we come to Western, the group here that we'll meet with will say, well, currently X percent of our students are finishing in the top 15% on that exam. And so over the next 4 or 5 years, we expect to move that number from wherever it currently is, let's say, up by 20% or 30%. And then we'll have gradations of that metric between now and 2015. The same for degrees and credentials conferred, graduation rates, et cetera. And we'll go right down this list. And then we will be tracking, and you will be tracking, how your campus is doing against those metrics. The other thing that I wanted to point out to you, and this again goes back to this college readiness issue. See what we've got up there. The readiness of all high school graduates in the region and the college-going rate of high school graduates in the region. We're going to be looking at the service region for Western and for Eastern and for all the rest, and actually be watching and measuring how that region is doing. And we'll see that some regions are going to outperform others. And what we want to do is learn from each other. This isn't going to affect funding or anything, but it is a way of saying and allowing us to being true to this college readiness stuff, to say to our campuses, if this particular region is underperforming the rest of the state, what could we do? And this would be in partnership, by the way, with the community and technical colleges, with the private and independent colleges, because it's regional. What could we do more or different or better in this region to help move those numbers? Because we're taking some ownership of this. So, anyways, I just wanted to share this with you to give you a sense of how all of this is going to work. It's pretty simple, and obviously the statewide data stuff will track to see how we're doing. To implement this, we're in the process now of actually setting targets with each campus, getting the implementation plan completed, and as we go forward, we will take out of all of the different strategies that are embedded in this. We haven't gotten into that level of detail, but let's say there's 30 different strategies. We'll probably identify the top 5 or 6 or 8. And then to the extent that those need budgetary support, we will be using those to go to the legislature to ask for the funding we need to help our campuses achieve or implement those various strategies. Here's the other thing that will be happening that is quite different from what we've been doing. If you were to come to a CPE meeting today, for the most part, it's my staff and my board interacting with each other one way or another. Going forward, I think starting at the June meeting, we are going to be asking the campuses to come forward, and each campus will be assigned one meeting a year, so they'll know in advance. But at that meeting, the campus will be afforded a half hour where the campus will come and present to our board on how it's doing. Now, these first round of meetings will be mostly describing, here's what our current status is. That'll be our baseline data. And then a year from now, the campuses will be coming back and saying, here's what our target is. Here's how much progress we've made. And hopefully, it will transform kind of our meetings to a much greater focus on our campuses, which is where it ought to be, rather than on my staff. And to the extent that we can work with each other to help each other achieve these objectives, my experience over the years, sometimes as we get into these things, a campus will not be at where you expect to be based on whatever your objectives are. So we use that to say, well, all right, what strategies are we using that maybe aren't as effective as they could be? What's worked someplace else? Or if you're ahead of a target, we might say, well, maybe we need to push that target out a little bit. But it will be, I hope, as collaborative an effort as we can generate, and a positive one, that will stimulate the kinds of improvements that we're going to need to make to address those challenges and objectives that I talked about at the beginning. This is just stuff that we're doing, and that's that. So I am grateful that you have given me this opportunity to come in and kind of give you a rough overview of this. I'd be happy to take any questions if there's time. And again, yes. Yeah.
Bob, and maybe I didn't hear this right, but early in your discussion, you said over in the last, say, 20 to 40 years, we've gone from, say, first in advanced degrees.
In bachelor's degrees.
Bachelor's degrees to 10th.
Yes, in the world.
In the world.
Right.
But as I look at our world or our nation today, we have more facilities, we have more money than we had 40, 50 years ago. What caused that?
Well, I think we've lost focus. I think we've become complacent as a nation about education and its importance. On the graph that I use, there's one country that really stands out in terms of improvement during this last 40 years, and it's South Korea. They went from 8% of their population with a bachelor's degree at a time when the United States had about 23%. That the United States has gone from 23 to about 30, 31, somewhere in there. They've gone from 8 to 34. If you look at the per capita GDP in that country, it is about half of Kentucky, and a little bit less than half of the United States. And so you say, well, they don't have more money than we have. But what they've got there is this focus and commitment and prioritization of getting their population educated.
Yeah, I think we've lost focus in this.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, we see all the time, I know Gary sees this, we go to community meetings, you go to our high schools, our elementary schools, and there, in too many of them, are people who are telling these kids, you'll never go to college. Don't go to college. I was at, I think it's Madisonville Community College, and I was meeting with students there. This is 3 months ago. And two of the students that were in the meeting I was in said to me that their high school guidance counselors told them, don't go to college because they don't care about you. And I said, well, you're here. What happened? And how do you feel? And they said, the people here at the community college care more about me than anybody, and I have more interaction with our faculty and advisors. But that's, you know, that's out there. There is this notion that if you're poor, if you're black, if you're Hispanic, you can't succeed. And so there's this kind of discouragement. There is a sense that I don't really need to go to college. You know, I'll get rich quick somehow. It's kind of all of that stuff playing into itself. I mean, the other thing...
Efforts like this are changing that, but on a global stage, we're now having to deal with our own educational success over the last century.
Right.
We've produced the technology, by and large. We've produced the educators. We've had the innovation. We've had the science and technology. We've had the social programs. And we've invested a lot in other countries and countries that have come out of World War II, where we've invested billions and billions of dollars into the redevelopment of those nations, are now reaping the benefits of that and in large measure. I mean, look, technology now makes the globe instant. I mean, communication and... The cultures are changing. That's why we're doing so much with China, because it's a future world language. Technology makes things instant. Governmental philosophies are changing, and we're going to get left in the dust, or we're going to embrace. But emerging democracies are now doing the kinds of things we began doing in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. And it's a numbers game. Sure. And I know we're talking about percentages, but we just look raw numbers. I mean, we don't have the populations that can compete when those countries are doing the same kinds of things that we've been doing for decades. And that's where those numbers are going to be reflected. So we've got to continue to shape the curve, or we're going to be looking around the curve at a lot of nations surpassing us in important measures.
Let me share one anecdote with you. I was at, by virtue of my job, I serve on the board of directors of the State Chamber of Commerce. So they meet periodically, and they had a meeting 2 weeks ago. I'm up in Covington, where their meeting is, and they bring in the CEO of a company that I had not heard of, but it's like the fourth or fifth largest employer in Kentucky. It's called General Cable. And they have nothing to do with cable TV. They make power cable, right? And communication cable. And it's very sophisticated cabling with all sorts of insulators and stuff on it, you know. And they have 14 facilities all over the world. And the CEO is explaining about their business and how they're expanding. And so I raised my hand, and when he's done, and I said, I have a question. I said, what could we do here in Kentucky to encourage you to invest more here and to grow more jobs in the state of Kentucky? And he was very polite, but over the next 5 minutes of his answer, essentially said not much. And here's why. He said, we expect from our workforce, regardless of where they are in the world, the same level of quality and the same level of productivity. And that's everybody from the people working in their factories where they're manufacturing the cable to their clean rooms where they've got to do stuff that relates to the materials they put in their cables. to the engineering talent that they have. So we have this notion that whether you work for us in North Africa or in Southeast Asia or in Eastern Europe or in South America, same level of quality, same productivity. Except there, they can get that same talent and same productivity as they get here in the United States for 10% to 25% of the price. So that, coupled with, like, 3 days later on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, is something about manufacturers expanding out, you know, all over the globe, not in the United States. So the challenge for us is recognizing that where we had the market on talent, that we no longer have that corner of the market, that there's talent everywhere. Okay, and it's just as good as us. We got to get better, okay, and we've got to be able to compete. And the only way we're going to compete is to get more of our people more highly educated, and to be the leading source of innovation, technological development, all that stuff. We can't do it if people don't finish high school. We can't do it if they finish high school but then don't do much more. So we've got to get people. I've always thought that what moves America is either fear or anger. And people ought to be scared to death that the quality of life and the prosperity of this country is going to decline if we don't fix this, and they ought to be angry as hell that we're kind of slogging our way through this and not really making the kinds of changes that
we need. Well, we got angry and we got fearful in 1957 with Sputnik.
Yeah.
This huge federal infusion of cash.
Right.
What is your group and your counterparts in the other 49 states doing to keep Pell Grant levels funded? Because when you look at the situation in Kentucky, everything that we try to do on this campus and other campuses, the bottom falls out if people don't have the funding to attend college. And any cut in Pell will kill us.
As recently as yesterday.
Okay.
I belong to an organization of people that do what I do. And obviously this Pell Grant issue is in front of Congress. The House has, you know, proposed significant cuts to Pell, and everybody wants to push back. The original proposal from our group, or to our group, was to sign on to a letter that says, don't cut Pell under any circumstances. We're more important than everything else. And my reaction, and I think the reaction of most of the other folks around the country, was, well, wait a minute. Everybody can say that about their pet funding thing, right? You know, the adage about don't tax you, don't tax me, tax the guy behind the tree. Well, just replace the word tax with cut, right? Is cut away, but don't cut my program. Well, I think we've got to be more responsible than that. And so the approach that we're going to take as a group, and I just got the draft of the letter yesterday that's been proposed, is we know that there are some inefficiencies in Pell in this sense. There's lots of money going to students who are enrolling in programs that are really deficient, talking to some extent about some of these proprietary schools that exist largely not to educate students but to just access this money. Billions of dollars. So one thing, and I'm not saying to put the proprietaries out of business, some are doing great work, but there's an awful lot that don't, okay, is that we need to tighten up on that stuff. Number two, I hear this particularly at our community colleges, that a lot of students come in, they're there just long enough to get their Pell Grant, they take the money and are gone, and have very little intention of earning a degree or being a student. It's just a source of money. Well, we've got to figure out how to deal with that. So just as an example. So what we're saying about this is, look, if we would be more appropriate in how this money gets distributed and manage the distribution of it, you could save a little money. We would have a much better, more robust, and effective program. Yesterday at CPE, while we weren't talking about Pell specifically, we did get into state financial aid. And this notion of how do we effectively link need-based aid and performance. Right? What we show, and we did this analysis about a year ago, is I asked our staff, I said, look, let's divide our students into six categories. I think it's six, maybe it was nine, now that I'm thinking about it. High performing, medium performing, low performing. High need, medium need, low need. The need you can just revert in terms of income, right? And so what we then did is after we created those modules, we said, well, all right, where's the money going? Right? For the most part, our state aid goes to the high, most of it, or the highest proportion of it, not most, but the highest proportion of it goes to high-performing, low-income students. That's what it should do, right? The question, though, is for students who are, let's say, medium performing but low need, in other words, high income, those students are getting a lot of money too. Not as much as these guys, but, you know, so the issue to me is, and it's kind of beauty's in the eyes of the beholder, but what's the right mix there?
How do you work your matrix?
Right?
Right.
And so we're talking about that, the Key Scholarship. Right now, you can earn Key Scholarship credit for fairly modest grades in courses that are not college preparatory.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe we ought to change the eligibility so that it has to be in college preparatory courses and it has to be at a higher grade level. That might allow us to use that money more effectively. Yeah, but so we're looking at all that stuff, and that'll go into that one thing we were talking about, affordability.
Great, thanks.
A lot of Pell Grant money is wasted, may not be the best word, but then we were talking earlier in our meeting about our retention strategies going forward, and when we lose 25% of our freshman class as they enter the sophomore year, that's millions of dollars in Pell Grant money that the 25% that don't return is lost. I mean, with no productive outcome.
You're looking at return on investment.
And just millions of dollars on this campus because we have a significant Pell Grant population in our student body, as do most Kentucky institutions. So our own persistence and retention efforts will make better use of that federal investment in those students when they arrive if we can help them finish.
You know, let me add one point to Gary's comment. I went down, I think my first year here, and visited Berea College. And Berea is a very special place, I suspect most of you know, but their students attend there at no cost. They get Pell Grant, state support, and anything that isn't covered, funds out of the campus endowment support those students. And it's quite a remarkable place. And they, the average income of the students that they admit to that institution are, I think, is $22,000 or $23,000 a family income. And they have the highest graduation rates of any college in this state, I think maybe with the exception of Center. And there is no gap between the graduation rates for white students and students of color. And so I assume, well, you must be cherry-picking, you know, the brightest students throughout Appalachia. That's not what they're doing. The average ACT score is about 23, 23 and a half. So these are good students, but they're not superstars. So I sat down and I talked with their administrators and finally got to the admissions people. I said, well, what are you guys doing? How are you, you know? Now, there's some other factors here because all their students work and the work experience helps integrate the kids into campus. But what they do is they interview every applicant and they have an interview profile that allows them to discern through the interview whether this particular candidate has the, whatever the attributes are they're looking for in terms of persistence, discipline, maturity, etc. Because if they're going to make that investment of their philanthropic dollars into these students, they want to be sure, as sure as you can be, that the kid has what it takes to get to the finish line. And so I think one of the things that we can do on on retention and graduation is also not necessarily to weed out kids who may be underprepared, because we're going to have to deal with those students, but to be looking for these other attributes, whatever they might be, that help tell us that this is a kid who has a high likelihood of sticking to it and succeeding.
Our time has run away.
Well, thank you all very, very
thank
much.
You.
Thank you, Bob. Well done. Bob.
Well, we're going to board the shuttle here. Where is that front?
Yes.
Gary?
Yes. And, you can leave your things in here if you'd like. Jeff's going to lock the door and keep it locked if you don't want to transport it on the shuttle, whatever you choose. Okay.